And welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising.
Hey listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue is the end-to-end solution for insight, outreach, and analytics for higher ed advancement and stewardship teams around the world. Recently, we launched Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub, where subscribers have access to over 100 hours of free, on-demand original series and podcasts, all created with fundraisers in mind. We're thrilled to feature the Development Debrief on Evertrue Studios podcast network. Check us out at evertrue.com/studios.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in. This week, we continue to drill down into the burning questions about AI and how it will change our work. What comes up again and again with Mark is how do we work alongside this technology? Listen to discover the answer to that question and several more. Mark Koenig is the Vice President for Technology and Chief Innovation Officer for the OSU Foundation. In this role, he serves as the foundation's technology strategist, including oversight of relationship insights, pipeline development, analytics, data and CRM operations, and technology services. Mr. Koenig is the past chair of the Eleusinian Advancement Executive Advisory Committee and the Council for Advancement and Supportive Education, CASE, District 8. In 2019, he received the Distinguished Service Award from CASE District 8, recognizing his many years of service to the organization, and in 2018, he received the Eleusinian Illumination Community Award, recognizing his dedication to infusing innovation throughout the advancement profession. Mark earned his bachelor's in history and economics from the University of Houston and a master's in adult education and organizational capacity from OSU. Now let's get started. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Debrief.
Hi, how are you?
Good. It's so great to have you on here continuing our theme of talking about artificial intelligence.
Yeah, it's exciting times for it. A lot of it's in the press. A lot of it's all over right now. So there's a lot of information coming at us. And a lot of it, I think, is folks not understanding what it is that we're trying to accomplish.
Well, and it's hot right now, but how long have you been working on it?
For about 5 years now. So it's not, honestly, I think folks, ChatGPT blew the lid off of this. And then, you know, of course, once people start playing with it, they also find all of the challenges and such with it as well at times.
And you think that people aren't understanding, do you think they aren't understanding the scope of it or even just the basics?
It's a little bit of the basics, because if you think of AI, it encompasses a lot of things. And it's one of the challenges that I've had even talking about the work that we're doing. We're doing more machine learning, which is a subset of AI, than we are actually trying to come up with an artificial intelligence that's going to tell us what to do. We'll get into that later, but that's, I think, one of the challenges with it right now is it's not really artificial intelligence. It's not replacing us. What it does, it's augmenting us if we're doing it right. It's giving us more abilities, and you're going to see humans work alongside the machines and be able to be more productive that way. Things like Copilot, things like ChatGPT, all of those. I mean, it's in almost every all the browsers now. It will help decide things. I literally just decided my kids' spring break trip this past weekend because I was behind. I hadn't scheduled everything, and we had the goal of getting down to Universal Studios in Hollywood from Oregon within like 5 days and be back. And so I just typed in, I want to take two young kids, put their ages in, what should I do? It was giving me suggestions for where to stay, things to do along the way that was kid-friendly. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we want. I mean, that's awesome. Yeah. It saved me tons of time of having to go to each site, look at each place, and oh, what's to do in Sacramento? What to do in San Francisco? And so, I mean, that kind of help is tremendous. So trip planning for any development officers, you can use that today and have it kind of spit out some suggestions and ideas. And sometimes they're on spot. So I use it in other ways too, around the house, between writing letters that I don't want to write or any kind of legal document or semi-legal document that you want. I've done NDAs with them. The challenge, and I saw a presentation recently from some colleagues at another university at the CASE conference, and they were talking about, I guess, an institution had used it to write a crisis communication. How do you do that?
I don't know that I would do that.
Exactly. I mean, low stakes, and you've got to be prepared to augment it because it will say some really stupid things. And it just draws from the information that's out in the web. And sometimes that's not always the greatest information to draw from. The folks that are literally just letting it do whatever, good. That's like rolling the dice in anything and saying, oh, I don't care today. Let's just let that thing do it. And I won't pay any attention to it whatsoever. I don't think that works out very well for people in general.
So tell us about what you've been working on over the past 5 years and your learnings at Oregon.
So we really started this, like you said, about 5 years ago. And I have my title, of course, is Chief Innovation Officer. So over the years, I garnered that partly from being, oh, innovation is it's where, it's through necessity, and
The
I'm forgetting
necessity
it.
of invention.
Yes, the necessity, right. And so for us, it was, I don't have a ton of money. I don't have a huge staff. I'm constantly trying to do things more efficiently on the cheap, so to speak. And I have a pipeline development department that just has two people. And I know many institutions have close to a dozen in their pipeline development and such. And I'm like, wow, I can. But what it allows us to do is it allows us to punch above our weight. And in that case, it allows us to take all of our predictive models. And that was the first thing that we did. Well, actually, let me be very clear. The first thing we did was make sure our data was as clean as humanly possible.
And
And
that
we
was
had
no small feat.
that took us 2 years to go through between the cleaning, the understanding. Once you start cleaning your data and start thinking of it and tagging it for machine learning purposes, you start realizing it maybe isn't as good as you thought it was. I'll use the case for us. We were early on looking at some contact reports in our predictive models and such. And unfortunately, because our contact reports tend to all be positive, it was in, I mean, everything came out of the model as unicorns, rainbow, and lucky charms falling from the sky. Well, that doesn't help us because there's no negative data. So, ergo, the model just thinks everything is positive. And that's a form of bias, obviously. And what we had to do is we had to start thinking about ways to make it easier for the development officers to put in that negative data. So, I tried to call, Catherine 5 times and she didn't answer. I actually want to know each time I tried to call you, when I tried to call you, what time of day I tried to call you. Because eventually I will have success at some point, as I know that Evertrue calls it polite persistence, and it was 6.6 times. Ours is 7.2 times, and it starts becoming, it is polite persistence, but I don't think there are many development officers right now that are thinking, I got to call Joey 7 times before he might pick up. They might try 2 or 3 times and throw in the towel. But obviously, there's ways to do that and the way to get their attention that through personalization at scale, understanding who they are, understanding their name, understanding their interests, understanding what speaks to them. That's incredibly powerful now that I send you a video and say, hi, Catherine, it's so nice to meet you. And, thank you so much for your gift to the underwater basket weaving program. We also like whales, they're underwater too. We have a whale talk coming up. Wouldn't you like to do that too? And you start to build rapport that way, as opposed to what most of us are getting in our inboxes, which is a deluge of emails every day from every company that wants to sell you something, not to mention the political donations that you might see during this cycle. You just get flooded. And so it's really hard to grab that attention and do it right when you're competing against a lot of people who are doing it poorly.
So, in terms of cleaning up the data, were you finding that more people needed to be assigned, or that some of the prospect portfolios needed to be de-densified? What did you find there?
From the pipeline, from the relationship insights, the pipe portfolio management side of things, what I'd like to say is there's different positions in a development organization. Not everyone is a closer. And co-presented once with David Lively, and I know David Lively likes the 45 people in each portfolio, and then you've got the perfect. The problem is I don't have enough people. I can't hire 500 people to manage a list of 10,000 people that could potentially give a gift. And let's be honest, they've never given a gift before. They look good on paper. They look good maybe if someone would reach out to them and create that relationship. But right now, we're finding those relationships to actually build them is taking for every 10 people, you might get one person. And that's being generous. I'm seeing some schools put a 20, 25 to 1 ratio there of outreach. Now, I'm curious to how much of that is are coming out of COVID and how much we're dealing with that. I think we forgot at times. It's real easy to forget. Trust me, I want to forget 2022 and 21 and 22. But nonetheless, they were still there and they still imprinted upon us. More of an isolation approach, I think. People are feeling overwhelmed in this society, the electronics, all of it. And that's one reason these platforms and such, especially the ones that allow you to do everything or give you every channel option. And one of those channels is hard copy mail. Here's a nice handwritten note. I always look around my desk for one because I love getting handwritten notes. I mean, honestly, I think everyone does. I mean, the fact that you get actual mail anymore is, and so I got a card the other day. It was a thank you card from our CEO, Sean, and he thanked me for something. And it was a handwritten card. I have that thing pasted up on my work desk and right at the top. It's wonderful.
Means a lot more
But
now,
we
too.
forgo that. We just forgo that because it's so much easier to hit that email. Oh, if the machine will just create a bunch of emails for me, I can really send them fast.
So just because we can do it doesn't mean we should, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, we have to be smart about it again, about being augmented as we started this discussion. If we're not augmenting it, if we're not putting our brains in there too, the machine is only so there's it's like a toddler, maybe. You want to let your toddler run and do things amok. It will get better. I mean, 10 years from now, it'll be a I think it's going to be a very different world. We're going to see very different approaches to things that we once did. I actually used in a presentation recently, and this was the CEO of Google back in 2018. His keynote rolled out Google Assistant. I don't know if you've seen that or not. If you haven't, it's well worth it. And so Google Assistant basically does two things for him. One, it books a haircut appointment for a woman. And basically, the conversation is all done by the robot on one side, and the other side is the actual hairdresser. And it makes her appointment. It asks the questions. Well, what kind of cut does she need? And it goes through the whole thing and sets it. The second one is probably even better. There's a guy who calls the robot is a guy, and it calls a restaurant that is not capable of really taking reservations. Let's not kid ourselves. The woman is like, huh? What? Who? Where? What? When? And the robot has to navigate that conversation where the woman is, frankly, the problem, not the robot. And he navigates it with grace and ease. And you wouldn't know the difference between a human call or a non-human call. And it's impressive. Now, as you can imagine, our work right now, I'm building out a discovery program. It's our second campaign. We're in the public phase. We're ready to contact 10,000 people. We're going to hire three, just three people. They're going to manage 1,000 people each. And within 2 to 3 years, they will have gone through the entire tip pool of 10,000 people. Well, if I could do that 10 years from now via Google Assistant and have those calls, would I take me 3 years to do that work? No, I'd have that work done in a weekend. All of it. Now, one would say, oh, those are robocalls. Yeah, that's the robocall of old. We all got used to get those robocalls. You can't tell the difference. And I even have gone so far to say sometimes in conversations where I actually have found myself in a robotic conversation, I'll say, are you a human? And their response to that is always fascinating. Sometimes it's a joke. Sometimes it'll be like, ha, 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 oh no, I'm real. And it's like, no, you're not. But the reality is it's really getting hard to tell. This is like the deep fakes, the other pieces that we're seeing. So you could imagine if that's the case, we don't have to do cold calls again. I hear the development officers around the world applauding because, one of the least favorite things to do are the cold calls and the
True.
t first time meeting somebody. And if that robot with the access to their information and their interests and such can weave a coherent conversation. Honestly, all we need them to do is to book the development officer visit, correct? No different than booking a haircut.
So you're thinking about AI in an external way, because I've had some guests on here talking about how we do our work, how we work with one
I
another.
am doing it all internal right now. See, this is the
Of
kind of stuff
course.
that
Yeah, no,
scares the
we're
heck out of people right now because it's
right.
not there yet. But
Right.
it will be in 10 years. There is no question it will. You will have political, you already got political campaigns right now doing it. You got Joe Biden calling you. You got Donald Trump calling. You got literally, it sounds like them and they're calling you. Why would he be calling me? Oh, it's the robot doing it. And they're starting to crack down on this. So I think there's probably going to be government getting involved in that. However, businesses are doing it every day. Have you called Verizon lately? This is where they don't necessarily take all of mine. So back to our story, though, we're not doing that stuff. This is the stuff that excites me. This is where I see the future going. For us, it's really about getting your data prepared. Tagging data is so incredibly important to
And
be
what do
able
you
to put
mean by that?
tags on it. So for example, you may have a field, let's just call it field X, and this field does some purpose for you. Well, that's the only purpose it does for you because you've set your data governance, it's there. Then you can tag that thing with all kinds of things that allow you to pull that data into other places and in other ways, in ways that the machine, when machine learning is taking it, and it will spin it out in a different approach. So it gives the data more depth. It gives it a more of a 360 view on that one data field. And that's pretty, I'm dumbing it down pretty far, but that's really the reason you tag a bunch of your data so you can have it and use it in different ways, more ways than what you said. This is the one data field it is. Oh, I need to create another data field and I need to create another data field. You can imagine how your data is exploding. For us, we just did a board presentation a couple of weeks ago showing them the explosion of the data over the past 2 decades. So, for example, in 2008, when I first started at Oregon State, we managed 2,800 people. That was it. We had about 40 development officers. We were in a campaign. We did great in that first campaign. However, I'm looking now, our number now is with these new 3 new positions, it's going to be 14,000 people. And all we did was add 6 more staff members. So, are all those staff members the same? Are they all closers? Full circle back to no, they're not, because we have donor experience officers that are truly stewardship for us. They are
They're
face to
higher
name,
volume.
1,000-person portfolios, 750 retention, 250 reacquisition. They don't do everything, and we all do it in our jobs. How many jobs do you have? The more jobs you have, the harder it is for you to focus on the job, task that you were assigned to do. And I think this is one of the things people don't understand about development officers. They've got a lot of competing, depending on your structure and everything. They might be reporting to the dean. They may have a chief development officer over here. They may have professors and all of these people wanting their time and attention to do things. And in addition, we're going to give them a portfolio of 1,000 people to call everybody and do it. It's not humanly possible.
Yeah, I
So
think
we.
prioritization is probably the hardest thing, harder than
Especially in
the
our,
actual.
especially in a nonprofit field. Hey, Mikey, can you do this too? You know, those kinds of things. And so another thing I will say about AI is it's not just for development. If you're in a fundraising outfit, you can think of it from security. You can think of it, how do I automate and prove drudgery? And I think of gift administration or processing, one of those areas. Data processing, another area. Those are areas that our eye is looking at that to, you know, use the technology and then start automating portions of those jobs. Again, not to replace them, but to augment them. Because when they're not doing that, they could be doing higher value items for us. They could be doing more auditing. They could be doing more gift compliance. They could be doing more customer service, as opposed to being buried under the architecture that was designed 40 years ago by somebody to book a gift somewhere.
What were the other learnings that came out of the last 5 years? It sounds like productivity's gone way up.
Well, in areas, I mean, part of this is for us, it was the having the ability to explore and learn along the way. And I don't want to, I never, you know, one of the things all of the staff, our own staff, as well as staffs elsewhere, are going to be working in this environment. So if I could give them a leg up and upskill them along the way. So when it finally does hit home and we are doing more, we're not going to be behind. Schools that are institutions and organizations that are waiting for this to be perfected are going to have the same journey piece. They're forgoing the fact that they need to clean their data. They need to take better care of it. Have they really invested in the data and done things over this time? Because I always love using this in presentations when I talk about data. There's a pug slide I put, and it's a pug, and it says, exercise. I thought you said extra fries. And so, just like exercise helps you lose weight and gets you in better shape, one learning I would say, I'm not a big fan of the whole process of data governance. So, 5 years ago, up until today, people will talk about data governance. It's really important. You have every single data point documented, and it's in a manual for someone to read at some point. Or you know what? How out of date that will be instantaneously upon publishing. It's like publishing a phone book. You know, it's data governance to me is a game that made somebody a lot of money. It's important that you understand and govern your data. Yes. But do you need to have a omnibus manual of every single data point? It's kind of like I like to say it's a perfectionist nightmare. You will never have all the data. You will never have the cleanest data ever. It's always going to be an 80% proposition. I mean, some people, when I first came here, this was a funny one. When I first came here, we had a 1.5% lost alumni rate. We were very proud of it. Very proud of it, the person who worked in that department. Well, that's great. I said, well, can you get me? I only had 15% employment on my records. I was like, you can have a 5% lost rate if you get my double the number of employment records I had. And so that's a good example of as leaders need to think of data acquisition as a strategic priority. Some of the schools I still talk to today don't even have outside of their board of trustees and maybe one or two of the big boards. They don't know who's in the underwater basket weaving in the College of Oceans or what. They don't know. And that to me is worrisome. That's the kind of data that we really want to be capturing. Are we going to be 100%? No. I'll be 80%. And 80% is better than no percent. It's
80%
just like
aren't good.
capacity ratings. We all know, and I don't care who's doing them or what. They all come from the same well, and they just put a different wrapper on them and they position them differently. But at best, they're 10% right. And people say, well, gosh darn it, why would you do it then? I said, well, 10% is better than no percent. It's
Right.
a arrow, it's a pointer for me. And I know that some will claim higher rates and such. But again, a lot of it's built off of, unfortunately, it's built off of real estate. And real estate has really changed in this country. Just look at California. Everybody's got a $1 million home.
Yeah, that is so true.
So, yeah. So about year three is when we finally started pulling it all together. Because what we did, and especially in AI, on back-end AI applications, there's front-end, ChatGPT, all of that, but then the predictive models, they usually answer questions. And a lot of times when you see these platforms, they're tiles, and these tiles all answer a different question. And in the case for us, we used a lot of them for things like likely to lapse, likely to increase to a certain level. Likely to, unlikely to. And so they had all of these and they would use them for segmentation during campaigns. Because back to my whole story earlier, stop sending it to 50,000 people because all you're doing is actually causing their inboxes. They're not just not hitting the inboxes of the people that you don't know, the people that you know it's going into their junk mail. And so, understanding email placement and box placement, you can actually hurt yourself thinking that I'm just going to add these extra people in here. You're better off going and targeting your messages. It will get to them, and there's a higher return rate when you do that. So, we used it in one of our first big campaigns out of COVID, because we started this work in 2019. 2018, honestly. So COVID comes along in 2020. We're all working from home, and we have this program called Beavers Care. And our alumni, excuse me, our annual giving, senior director for annual giving, Tyrell Warren Burnett, he created what we call Beavers Care. And Beavers Care was a program to help students during the COVID time with food and all the insecurities that we were all dealing with, rent, you name it. And that program raised, I want to say, 1.2, 1.4 million, don't quote me. But in the program, the digital side, we raised, I think, 600,000 or 700,000. So a lot of people, anytime, you know, there's always the digital side, and then there's the side of donors will open, you know, talk to the development officer and put money towards that. So in the digital side of the campaign, it was the first time we introduced auto retargeting. So same thing you get from any other vendor. Hey, you left something in your cart. That provided 30% more gifts in that total of 600,000 than not. So we would have not had 30% of those guests if we had not retargeted. We have retargeted every time since, especially if it makes sense. We have it usually increases the campaign by 25%.
So what does that look like? Is that in the form of an email? And what does it say? We saw you on our site.
It says something about along the lines of, you know, it's really important that students get the, you know, it's not necessarily, hey, you left this in your box, you know, like some of them do. You know, you have to be tactful in it. But I mean, customers do that all the time. What's really neat is within those gift, we call them smart gift forms, and those gift forms allow us to know so much more than we used to know, like how many people are dropping off at what questions you're asking, how many, what's the, you know, do we find that people get stuck somewhere? One of my favorite things was the one donor was trying to make a gift 18 times. Well, obviously, we all design things the way we design them, the way we think people will navigate through something, right? And this person was just doing everything the opposite way that any kind of designer would ever do. It's like that video, my favorite video of the, oh, they've got the old perfection game where you put the different pieces into the, like the round peg goes in the round hole, the square peg goes in the hole. Well, you know, it was like there's a cute video online for a round design, and the, you know, oh, it's a round when it goes in the round hole. No, it goes in the square hole. Oh, it's a rectangle. It'll go into the, or it goes in the square hole. And they just put everything in the same hole. And that's the way you kind of learn about human behavior, because we all want to know what human behavior is. Marketing, I mean, they've been trying to figure this, the crystal ball, for years. I'm a big fan of marketing on the side, that kind of data collection, the either you know, especially the marketing analytics. So thinking back to the day there was Prism scores. Do you remember Prism scores?
No.
Okay, so Prism scores were a way of codifying folks from different regions to give you an idea of the consumer you might be working with. And it's actually really fun to go back because it was rudimentary at the time, but it still holds some value and it's still used today. So there were little classifications where they would say the type of donor, big fish, small pond. So someone who had a large job in a small town. Still not the same as, you know, I forget what they called the big city rollers or what. They all had these cutesy names, and they went down,
That's so
and frankly, there was
interesting.
like 70 of them, but they all took in several classifications, basically like mini personas. And persona work is really tough. And I know we all aspire to persona work, but usually where we get into it, we don't have enough capability to slice and dice in that realm. You know, you need multiple personas, not two personas. I mean, a persona will help you, but two of them is not going to change the game for you. And so, what's nice about the machine learning for us is we started a program. This was around year four. We started recognizing that over the years, we've tried to collect interests a variety of ways. I think everyone's tried to collect interests, and you probably have a bunch of interests in your system. There might be four people interested in, I don't know, baking. Great. What do you do with that? It's really hard. So we took a step back and said, give me the root of all of the different trees. Kind of like if you're ever familiar with SEC codes or now NAIC codes, right? And you're like, oh, I'm in technology and I can have 28 different jobs under technology and the fields, same concept. So we pulled it back to the top tree roots. We used GuideStar, which is a nonprofit. They post 990s out there, but they had an interest model that was pretty, I want to say basic, but it is co basic at core. We're going to expand upon it, but we needed something to start off the framework with. So now we have the ability to track a variety of ways of interests. So we just launched our sixth Building Community Initiative survey. The first one started in 2009. This survey measures the alumni's feelings about their institution, about the brand, about the value of their degree, and how they like to be around their peers. It's an ethnographic or a qualitative survey that we then quantitate. So you get scores on a Likert scale of 1 through 7, and one, simply you hate us, 7, you love us. I know that sometimes hate's a strong word, but I will come back to that in a second.
And I know in my personal experience, I always find something to change on our lists. There's always something that is out of date or.
I'll use this. This is actually a really great example. At the time, had an individual, we got a major, our first major gift prediction. So we've built out predictions for annual giving, major gifts, planned giving, and engagement at this point. So I can tell you who likely to volunteer or not.
Well,
So.
Mark, this has been so interesting, and I feel like we've just scrape
We
the surface
started.
with you. There's so much more we could have talked about, but I would love to wrap up with asking you, what do you know for sure?
For sure. One of the things I look to is the CEO of NVIDIA often. He came out recently and said, in 5 years, there will be no coding. Yeah, let that soak in, especially anyone that's listening to this that is a coder currently. Hey, I pull SQL lists all the time. Guess what? Hey, Siri, give me left-handed Fijians that have given $50 to the underwater basket weaving program through the course of the years of 1998 to 2004. Your answer is
Whoa.
that's the thing that is, how are we going to be prepared for that? How are we? And honestly, as I look to our organization, I see this as basically future-proofing our organization. It's going to allow us to continue the work, the good work that we do, no matter the economics that will occur. We're not out to automate the individual. We're out to automate their drudgery and their processes. And I
Yeah,
think
that's
that's an important thing as we start to look towards tools and other things that we're starting to see adapted or adopted within technologies, is really look to what they're trying to accomplish. If they're trying to automate you, I would say that might not be the best. You know, what I want is to have more free will, not to be predetermined what my day is going to be. But I want to be able to spend my time the best way I can possible. And that's going to be augmented. No matter what list I get, no matter what I do, I'm going to see Joe number 10 on the list and say, I got to get a hold of Joe today because I know where Joe is and I need to. But the other 9 before him may come behind. That's the augmentation because humans, I mean, development officers have really hard jobs. It's having to create relationships. So this is coming from an introvert, so I don't like having to deal with people that much. But they do have to, you know, they have to create that relationship. They have to, you know, encourage the donor to make that gift, and that's not easy work. It's not something that can be automated. That's the art to the work, but
So
it
is
can
that
be
what you know for
augmented with
sure?
science. Well, one, there's not going to be coding. How do we work alongside this? Really, I think that's for sure. If we don't, then we're going to have some really weird, disoriented work. Who's going to want to do the job where they come in and do something a robot can do, but the
Yeah,
robot's telling
absolutely.
them to do it?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, this has been fun, Catherine, so thank
Thank you,
you.
Mark.